This show is now live and local. It's your connection to local performances. Coming up, I'll be talking with David Commande, who is music director and conductor of the Heartland Festival Orchestra based in Peoria. They're giving a concert of string music by English and American composers Saturday at Five Points, Washington, for a 7:30 concert, so that conversation coming up. First, I'll be talking with Mark Morris, who is of course, the director, artistic director of the Mark Morris Dance Group, which is currently visiting its Midwest home, as they call it, at the Krannert Center in Urbana, and for performances, two performances, tonight and tomorrow, and then a couple of others locally as well. And they always perform with live music, which is a hallmark of theirs. Among the pieces on the program is called Festival Dance, danced to this music. That is the beginning of the last movement of the Piano Trio No. 5 by Johann Nepomuk Hommel, a performance by the Borodin Trio, and the closing rondo there. The complete work will be performed by musicians associated with the Mark Morris Dance Group as a dance called Festival Dance, and that's part of the program being given by Mark Morris and Company tonight and tomorrow at the Krannert Center in Urbana at 7:30 each evening. They're also performing a couple of other outreach events through the rest of the week, because they're always here for a residency in which they spend some time teaching folks. And in the case of on Friday, working with some people with Parkinson's disease, a dance with Parkinson's event, which happens periodically, and then giving a presentation for children at the Champaign Public Library on Saturday. Mark Morris is my guest for this portion of Live and Local, and you not only return to the Krannert Center every year, but this is your, I think, our third conversation on this program.
At least.
Coming in.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's great to talk to you all the time, and not least because you do make such a big deal out of working exclusively with live music, which not all dance companies do.
Well, I also insist on live dancers, which is something that most companies do.
They do that, yeah.
But
you're not unique there.
That's right. No, I don't know. I get so many interviews where the question is, why live music? And I get that so much that I end up being in a defensive position, and I now respond with, why not? Why am I the freak? And the answer is that we've, as dancers, have become accustomed to working with, you know, recorded music of whatever. You know, people have a record collection and they, or not anymore, you know, they have an iPod, and make up dances to the music that they know, and they very often don't go as far as finding out if there's a pianist who could play a reduction or a drummer or no music or anything. And it's not that all music is written to be played live, of course, but I think if you're going to do it, you should really go all the way.
Well, I would think that one of the risks that dancers may feel is that you have a recording, you know what the tempo is, as you get in a performance, you have live players, and all of a sudden you don't know what the tempo is going to be. I mean, for example, when I started to play the piece we just heard,
right,
you didn't know what recording I was playing.
Right.
And in fact, I think you said it took you a moment to recognize, oh, what piece is that? It's much slower than we do.
That's
it.
That's right, exactly.
So did you, when you set the piece in the first place, did you decide, I'm going to set it in the way that I've heard it on recording? Or did you hear it once and then say, oh, I'm going to do what I want with it?
I nearly never base my reading of a piece of music on a recording. So, you know, I'll hear, you know, I listen to music all the time, certainly. I have a big collection. I go to concerts. And there's, of course, so much music that hasn't been recorded that is wonderful. So in finding this piece, I was listening to a bunch of Hommel. I'd used a little bit of his music before, and I heard this piece and loved it from that last movement that you just played. And so then as soon as I decide on something, I get the score and work from there. So, you know, it's a rondo, and so I do what I think it should be tempo-wise as a rondo, and so that it dances well. And often my readings of music are slower than the tempo markings indicated, because it's, you know, your body is bigger than the fingers you need to play the piano with or the violin. And so sometimes I slow down fast stuff and slow down slow stuff. But in this case, it's very expressive and sort of not exciting enough for me. I mean, it's a really good recording. It speeds up and there's a lot of rubato and it's interesting. But, you know, there's no one definitive way to play a piece of music. And I work in the studio with a pianist. In fact, the pianist, Colin Fowler, who performs with us. So I make up the dance in the studio with a musician, with a pianist, and no recording ever. I'll play a recording for the dancers to hear orchestration or, you know, if there's choir or something like that. But they learn the dance from someone playing it from the score. So, you know, I don't do anything crazy. I don't do crazy editings or pastiche or anything like that. So, but it's my reading of a piece that the musicians end up playing.
So if you heard something, decided to choreograph it, and felt that, well, this should go faster than this, and say Colin sat down and wanted him to do the tempo you had in mind, mm-hmm. and he might say, we can't do that.
Maybe, yeah.
Which is the reverse of what is more likely to happen, where the dancers might say to a conductor, we can't do that tempo you're trying to get.
Well, there's a long history of, let's say, not perfect cooperation between the pit and the stage. You know, they often don't understand each other's jobs, especially if a conductor comes in and, you know, a guest conductor comes in and it works with the band and doesn't know the dance very well. And then the dancers, of course, are used to people, especially in a big ballet company, you're used to your solo being at this speed no matter who else is, you know, is playing or dancing. And I tend not to do that. You know, the old story attributed to various conductors is, how do you want the music tonight, too fast or too slow? Because that's, you know, very often music people presume that dancers are on a click track and we only are responding to speed, and that's not true. I mean, it is true if you're only working with recorded music and you don't have the imagination and the sort of spontaneity to perform and to rehearse and to perform every day with living people playing music. It becomes easier and more fun and more interesting and more complicated.
Do you always travel with your own musicians? I think it's a loaded question, partly because I did see a couple of names on your program that I recognize from having just sung in the University of Illinois Opera a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, I have a couple of singers who are from here who are joining us for the Beethoven songs. So, but I bring piano, violin, cello, and a tenor come with me, a baritone who's singing a tenor part and a baritone part in this show. And so I brought almost everybody, and I added a couple singers from here, which is a great opportunity for them and for us, because we continue our sort of coordination with the community here. And it's a piece that we've done a lot. And so, you know, it will be done the way we do it. But these two singers are joining us just for this gig.
So does that mean wherever you perform this piece, which we're now segueing okay. to the next topic, I guess, these pieces being a bunch of folk songs set by Beethoven of all pieces, Irish and English and Scottish folk songs,
right.
I don't know what your mix is, wherever you perform this piece, do you pick up singers along the way?
No, it's rare that we do that. But we are on this trip because it worked out that way kind of well. So, you know, what the answer to the previous is that if I'm doing a big orchestra piece or a big choral piece, I very often will use the orchestra and the chorus of wherever we're going, and I'll bring maybe soloists and certainly a conductor, and very often the continuo if I'm doing Baroque music, or the soloist if it's a concerto or something like that. So I don't travel with a giant symphony orchestra yet. So, what is called the Mark Morris Dance Group Music Ensemble ranges from solo keyboard to a pretty full-size orchestra, as we just did at Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York. We just did Four Saints in Three Acts and the Beethoven Choral Fantasy, and it was with the Trinity Choir from New York that we hired, and then the band is my own band. People I work with all the time and are hired to play with our gigs. It's
when
wonderful.
You're in New York.
Yeah, and a lot of those are people part of that group is who's on tour with us. So it's a roster of wonderful musicians who are interested and keen and who play with us all the time. We're very good friends and colleagues.
You said if you do have a piece with orchestra, you'll usually bring a conductor along.
Mm-hmm.
You have been known to bring yourself along as the conductor.
That's right. I'm conducting some. Oh, I have here, and I'm doing some more this later in the spring. I'm conducting in New Haven, so I have a limited repertory of conductorial achievements, and I'm adding gradually. It's not what I'm aiming to do when I retire from whatever it is I do now, choreographing, but it's something that I love. It gives me a new insight into the music we're working with, and I'm cheap.
Yeah, well, there's that point, too.
Cheap/free. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, well, so these Beethoven songs, which mm-hmm. is the Hummel piece is the second thing on the program.
Yes, it is.
First thing, you're calling it the Muir, M-U-I-R.
Right.
And there's these Beethoven songs, and then you have another vocal piece, really unusual one, we'll talk about it in a little bit, mm-hmm. With music by Erik Satie.
Right.
I would think it would be harder to set, I'm not sure why I think this, to set music with words than instrumental music.
Oh.
Is it or isn't it?
Well, I do it all the time because I love to do that. But one thing that's strange is that, the response, a public response and critical response varies depending on if it's in English or not. if we're in an English-speaking place like the U.S. So I love vocal music, and I've always worked with it, even when I was working only with recorded music in the very earliest days of my choreographic time, partly because the words exist pretty much always before the music does. So the composers are handling the problems of getting the text across to a listening public. So the music, famously Schubert's great, great 5,000 songs that he wrote are all varied and all interesting because of his great sensitivity to sung text. So what we think of as songs almost always were just spoken poetry that then somebody brilliantly set to music, and that becomes how we know a piece. And so in this case, Beethoven was commissioned by a publisher to set traditional folk songs of Britain, of the British Isles, for parlor performance at home when people could actually play the piano at home. And so he wrote a couple hundred settings of these songs, some very well known, Auld Lang Syne, God Save the King, and others that are stranger. And he didn't speak English very well or at all. And so the settings are very interesting because I guess he had some clue about what these pieces were about. But the sort of the bridge music, the stuff between verses, is always really strange and in a beautiful Beethoven way, a surprise that brings you back to the next verse. So although some of the songs are quite familiar, the point of view of Beethoven is just wonderful and interesting. And it's for, in this case, it's mostly Scottish songs, which is why it's called the Muir, which is a moor, And it's for a soprano, tenor, baritone, and a piano trio.
Piano trio meaning violin, cello, and piano.
Right.
And let's hear a couple of these. The violinist is Ani Kavafian, the cellist is Yo-Yo Ma, and the pianist Samuel Sanders, the late Samuel Sanders. And tenor Robert White. Mm-hmm. You just told me I thought he was gone, and you said he's still singing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I met him at a dinner party a while ago, and he introduced him. He was sitting next to me, and the name sounded familiar, and it turns out he had just come back from a performing tour. He still performs. Wasn't born yesterday, and he's a wonderful singer.
Here he is in a couple of folk songs, which I believe are two that you have set for this piece called The Muir. We're talking with Mark Morris of the Mark Morris Dance Group, who are performing at the Krannert Center in Urbana tonight and tomorrow night.
Cease your funning, Thoros, or come. Thank you.
Those were two folk songs set by Beethoven. We heard Cease Your Funning and then Sally in Our Alley, both of them sung by Robert White and performed by Ani Kavafian on the violin, Yo-Yo Ma on the cello, and Samuel Sanders piano. Quite a nice selection of Beethoven's folk song settings are going to be performed by the Mark Morris Dance Group tonight and tomorrow at the Kranert Center in Urbana in a piece called The Mirror. And Mark Morris is with us, my guest here on Live and Local. And as you said, there are so many of them. How on earth did you narrow down? What were your criteria in making choices?
Well, you know, there's so many. There are also settings by Haydn and by other people around the same time. And one thing is, you know, a lot of folk songs, I'm sorry to say, tend to sound similar. And, you know, they have like 500 verses, like Froggy Went A-Courtin' or something. You know, it's like I'm a huge fan of the Carter Family, and I can listen to endless hours of the original Carter Family. But really, you know, it's mostly three chords and pretty much all in the same key and the same kind of tragic story or whatever. So, the Jilted Lover one, you know, the sad historical one, I was trying to do things that had a variety of tone, a point of view of a man or a woman, you know, fast and slow, different keys, different treatments. So to make it a variety instead of just an endless catalog of a bunch of songs that end up blurring together. So it was mostly to make it an interesting stretch of, I don't know how many we do, maybe seven or eight songs.
So probably they're so well and interestingly set, any of them would have been fine. You just needed to come up with a good program.
Yeah. In fact, when I first choreographed it, I did it as a study for just three people and maybe four songs. And then I expanded it for six people, three male-female couples, and I sort of doubled the amount of songs. So that was an interesting thing to add on to something, to expand it, to sort of augment it and make it a fuller piece.
So this is definitely a piece where you have brought your own musicians, as you said earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm going to play the opening of the piece, the music that begins the closing piece on your program, which mm-hmm. is, the piece is called Socrates, so is the piece of music by Erik Satie. This is a piece that I had heard of, but I had never heard before until yesterday, and I'm willing to bet that none of your audience will have heard it before unless they've seen your piece. So let's listen a little bit first.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about it because it's a really curious choice for choreography. As I said, I'd never heard that piece before yesterday, and apparently I heard part of the piece that wasn't part of the piece. Mark Morris recognized immediately that the music I started with didn't belong to Socrates by Erik Satie. The banding, as it turns out, is all messed up on this particular CD. We don't really know what's going on. But we did come back in and hear part of enough of the piece that you kind of get the idea, I think, of why I might have said this is an unusual piece to choose to choreograph, because for most of it, there's this long, 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 long dialogue between a couple of people, Socrates mm-hmm. and these other folks that he
right.
talks with.
Yeah.
And how do you dance to that?
Well,
why?
It says it's a very strange history. The piece was written as sort of an experiment in blankness. It was written in the teens, the 19-teens. And Satie wanted to write a piece that he said was as white as antiquity. And of course, thinking then that old ruined buildings were bleached white as opposed to being painted garishly as we now assume that they were. So he took three bits from Plato. The first moment where you heard we heard the soprano sing at the end of that, which was from Symposium, and it's a toast about, you know, at a dinner party about Socrates. Then you heard the beginning of the second movement, which is called On the Banks of the Ilissus, which is a conversation from Phaedrus. And then the last, and those are very short movements. The last movement is from Phaedo and is the famous, the death of Socrates, which is, that one movement is about 15 or so minutes long. And it's, there are no repeats. It's written in the score, lisant, read, as though it's being read instead of sung. It's a very, very plain piece. It was written for orchestra and as many as four sopranos singing the different parts. But I heard a recording years ago of the great tenor Hugues Queneau, and in piano. So, and Satie himself used to perform it for vocal and piano. So I like that better than the orchestra version, although I had choreographed The Death of Socrates in the early 80s to a recording of the orchestra because I didn't have any money for musicians. So, and couldn't get the score. I couldn't get the rights to perform it. So I just made a chart to break down the music for myself. So I choreographed the last movement many years ago. And then just last year or so, I went through and did the whole piece in these three movements for tenor and soprano. I mean, sorry, for tenor and piano. And it's about 30 minutes long, this piece. And it's very placid. And it's the first dance in my life where I supply super titles because the text is so beautiful and so important and so unusual. So this was, it was a favorite piece of the great John Cage, who was a big fan of Satie's, and it's a famous sort of oddball piece from Western music literature that was, it was written without climaxes. It seems like it's going to be the most boring thing in the world, and it is actually very, very emotional and tender and very, very interesting. And so I made up a dance through trial and error. I think it's for 15 people in my company. It's a very big dance. And it's these three points of view of Socrates himself has maybe two lines in the whole thing. Otherwise, it's a toast to him, a description of a walk by the river with Socrates, and then the famous drinking of hemlock and the death of Socrates. But it's a very beautiful sort of Pacific dance and piece of music, wonderful music.
Sorry, I turned my mic down. So do you attempt to depict all of these lines? This is not poetry at all. It's just long text. For example, right, the beginning of the death says, "After Socrates was found guilty, we went to see him every day without fail, the open-air court where the sentence was passed and was just next to the prison," et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Do you try to depict all that, or does just send you on flights of fancy?
It's both. The second movement by the Ilyssus River, the dance, although it represents some of what's being said, which is describing various mythological stories that happened in certain spots along the river, it's really Socrates going for a walk barefoot as he always was on a beautiful day. So the dance itself goes only in one direction from where you're looking at it, from right to left. It never stops rivering itself that way. In the last movement, it's in three groups of five. Five people are off stage. Five people are presenting the rhythm sub layer of the piano part, and then five people are representing what the text is saying. So the story's in there. It's not a narrative dance. It's an evocative dance, and the text is there if you want to read it. It's sung in French. It's a French translation of Plato. So it's a very interesting, very beautiful piece that I'm very happy with.
Mark Morris Dance Group, led, of course, by Mark Morris, my guest here on Live and Local, will be performing his Socrates with text by Plato, music by Eric Satie tonight and tomorrow night at the Krannert Center in Urbana, along with pieces set to music by Johann Nepomuk Hummel and Beethoven's settings of a bunch of mostly Scottish folk songs. And other public performances on Saturday, Friday morning at 10 o'clock, the occasional Dance for Parkinson's is open to you, even if you don't have or know somebody with Parkinson's. It's a very interesting time, and there'll be folks involved in the dance company working with them. 10 o'clock Friday morning at the Krannert Center in one of the rehearsal rooms. And then on Saturday at the Champaign Public Library, program particularly targeted for children at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon, part of the annual Mark Morris residency that's been happening at the Krannert Center since 2001. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our show is made possible with support from The Illinois Chamber Orchestra in their fresh and fortuitous concert featuring Beethoven's Fourth Symphony and Vaughan Williams' Wasps Overture with guest conductor Ken Lamb on Friday, March 16th at St. Agnes Church in Springfield and Saturday, March 17th at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington. Information is available at ilsymphony.org. Stay tuned next for my conversation with David Commande, conductor of the Heartland Festival Orchestra in Peoria, who give a concert on Saturday night for strings. We heard a bit of the introduction to The Introduction and Allegro by Edward Elgar in a performance by strings of the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner. That piece will be on a concert that's called Old and New World Strings by the Heartland Festival Orchestra in the Peoria area. The concert will be on Saturday at 7:30 at Five Points Washington, which is located in the Caterpillar Performing Arts Center. 7:30 concert. And my guest on this portion of Live and Local is the artistic director and conductor of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, David Commande. And thanks for this return appearance, David.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm pleased to be back.
So this program called Old and New World Strings, referring to the old world of England and the new world of the United States. What was your, besides that obvious juxtaposition, what was your thinking in coming up with this particular program?
Well, I wanted to highlight the quality of our players, of our string players, who are at the core of our sound of any chamber orchestra. They play spectacularly, and being a string player myself, I'm so aware of the expressive power of the string body, and there's such marvelous music written for it. And so one of the anchors of this whole program was featuring works written for strings. And as is typical with programs, ideas come in from past experience, and obviously pieces that I either know and have done or that really struck me. And then as I work forward, it's just how the pieces fit together. And it all coalesced in this theme of old and new world. Really, more or less, this program runs from through the first half of the 20th century, 1905 to 1950, roughly. And it is interesting because half of the program seems to look back in time, musically speaking, to the earlier Romantic period, and half of it looks forward to into the heart of what we consider to be 20th century music. So it really is, in a way, it's a little bit like a 19th and 20th century program, even though it's explicitly from only within the 20th century.
Well, Edward Elgar straddled the centuries, born in the middle of the 19th and made it well into the 20th. Aaron Copland, I think, exclusively in the 20th century. Arthur Foote is an interesting composer. He's an American who was considered one of the our early romantics, I guess, or late romantics. I'm not sure how he falls.
The Boston Six, it seems to me. He studied with John Knowles Payne at Harvard. There was Chadwick and Amy Beach and Edward McDowell and Horatio Parker, along with Arthur Foote, and they people tend to consider him the great romantic among them. But it's ironic because to our ears he sounds very much backward listening, and yet at the time, in the late 1800s, when he was championing the music of Brahms and Wagner, he was considered a very much forward-looking kind of radical guy. That was that period in Boston when some critics were saying, in case of Brahms, use this exit door.
Yeah, so, it's sort of difficult to imagine Brahms is considered to be avant-garde in any way.
Yeah, it is.
At one point. Arthur Foote, certainly not avant-garde now, but also not played very often. I've often wondered why in listening to some of his music, which is really quite enjoyable. You've chosen his Suite for Strings. I think there's another string piece of his that that I haven't heard.
There is a serenade, which is quite nice. And then he's very well known for his night piece for flute and strings. Very, very beautiful. And that's the piece that he wrote that first caught my attention. That's when I first learned about who Arthur Foote was. And a lot of his chamber music actually is played, but not as much as it could or should be. Very beautiful piano quintet and piano quartet as well.
Well, we'll sample some of the very opening of this piece. It's the Suite for Strings of Arthur Foote. I have to say, the recording we have here, I don't think is wonderful, but at least it'll give people an idea of the sound of the piece. This is the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Kenneth Kline. And the entire piece will be played, it's a three-movement piece, will be played by the Heartland Festival Orchestra at their concert on Saturday at Five Points, Washington, under the baton of David Commande, my guest on this portion of Live and Local. That's the opening of the Suite for Strings in E major by Arthur Foote, American composer. Performance here by the strings of the London Symphony, led by Kenneth Kline. And the strings of the Heartland Festival Orchestra in Peoria will be doing this at Five Points, Washington on Saturday in an all-string program, including strings that aren't necessarily... Well, actually a qualification here. In an almost all-string program, but including strings that you wouldn't... While they are string instruments, you wouldn't necessarily normally include in a string program, namely the piano and the harp, which are plucked or struck string instruments. And they're both involved in the one piece that includes a completely non-strung instrument.
non-string.
Non-string, non-strung, yeah, the clarinet. Music by Aaron Copland. How did this sneak onto this program?
Well, it's snuck on, you know, it's interesting because the strings, in this case, we're hearing not only in the case of the harp and the percussion, the piano with its percussive quality, but also among the regular strings, we're hearing the strings utilized in a somewhat different way and intentionally by Aaron Copland. This piece, which was commissioned by Benny Goodman, and Benny Goodman's comment about it, he said, well, I paid him $2,000 for this piece, which was good money in those days. Benny Goodman, I'm sure the listeners know, was really a jazz star, but he went out of his way to commission works from the premier classical writers of his age, including Stravinsky and Bartok, besides Copland. And so he asked for this piece, and obviously because of Goodman's realm, musical realm, he was inclined to take on a jazz feel and sound to this piece. But lacking percussion instruments, he made a point of using percussive effects, which the strings can achieve, with pizzicato and with the bows. So we're hearing another side to what the string instruments can do. And so I suppose if it's a portrait of string playing, this opens up a whole other realm of what they can do, stylistically and literally, technically.
So who is your Benny Goodman stand-in?
Our Benny Goodman is David Gresham, our principal clarinet, and this was also an opportunity. I've had this piece in the back of my mind, honestly, and looking for a spot to feature David and a work on which to feature him, because we do look for opportunities to highlight and showcase our wonderful players in the orchestra. So I was looking for a spot, and this piece was in the back of my mind and the string theme, and so it all came together. And David Gresham is on the faculty at Illinois State University. Great
and,
player.
Yeah, so let's hear. This is an interesting piece. It's got one of the most gorgeous movements in its opening half or so. I guess it's more than the first half of the clarinet concerto. And then you get a complete contrast in the second portion, although he sneaks into that second portion. This performance here, given by the clarinetist Paul Meyer, who's a Frenchman, I believe, and the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by David Zinman. So we have a little French, a little English, and a little American in the case of the conductor. It'll be an English and American program by the Heartland Festival Orchestra, including this music on Saturday at Five Points, Washington. That's the theme of the piece called Variations on a Theme of Frank Bridge by Britten here on Live and Local. And so, David, what treatments does he subject this to?
Well, following the titles of the variations, he seems to be traveling in time and place and musical form. There's a march, there's an adagio, there's a march, a romance, aria italiana, bourrée classique, vina valza, moto perpetuo, and the funeral march and chant, ending up with the fugue and finale. And so it's almost like you'd almost consider it a very advanced composer's what do you call it with petit point when you do the letters? You know, it's like a demonstration of what all he can do. But the interesting thing beyond all of that is that his goal. He wrote a note to Frank Bridge in the score, not for publication, but it's come down to us, in which he explained that each one of these movements is intended to portray aspects of Bridge's personality, and so qualities of integrity and energy and charm and humor and so forth. So that's an interesting counterpoint to his purposes in all of this, at the same time going through these various forms. So the Vina Valsa, you know, it's not surprising that he calls it that. It's obviously in 3-4, and it's his very own take on that. Or the brilliant Aria Italiana, which is supposed to portray Bridge's humor. Really wonderful. And, you know, I should mention, because it comes to mind, like so many programs, this one has sub-themes and counter-melodies, so to speak. Ballet is one of them because I first became acquainted with the Introduction and Allegro of Elgar through a ballet version of it. And similarly, although I had heard it, I got to know this work much better for ballet. So that's one of the subtext to this whole program, although it's a personal one. But this music is highly dramatic and eminently danceable.
Well, if you'd like to get tickets, you can go to the website for heartlandfestivalorchestra.org, and basically all the info you need is right there, the specifics. The concert's called Old and New World Strings at Five Points Washington, located in the Caterpillar Performing Arts Center in Washington, Illinois, 7:30 on Saturday. And David Commande is the conductor. As always, they have a community partner who receive some of the proceeds, and they are called Look, It's My Book. You can even find out about them on the website as well. And it's an nearly all string program, music by Elgar Copland, Foote and Britten. And we'll wrap up here with the movement that David mentioned, the Wiener Walzer, or Viennese Waltz, from the Variations on a Theme of Frank Bridge here on Live and Local. David, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And I should mention one last HFO tradition. We will have a surprise in this program, as always.
Which, of course, we won't talk about.
And we won't give it away now.
It wouldn't be a surprise, but it'll be there, give you another incentive to go. Thanks very much. That's a portion of the Viennese Waltz from the Variations on a Theme of Frank Bridge by Benjamin Britten here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We have support today from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. Illinois Public Media is 90 years old. We'll kick off a year of memories and celebrations with a visit by Andrea Seabrook, NPR congressional correspondent. Join Andrea and the WYNL News team for a wine and cheese reception at Campbell Hall on Wednesday, April 11th. Tickets are $25 per person. Call 217-333-7300 for reservations. You're listening to 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 77 degrees currently. We're on our way to a near-record high, around 80 degrees. It will be partly sunny this afternoon. It's a minute past 1 o'clock.